Look at the device you're using to listen to this audio right now. Like, whether it is a smartphone resting in your hand or maybe a laptop open on your desk.
Yeah, or even just wireless earbuds tucked into your ears.
Yeah.
You know, you are interacting with a piece of technology that is, quite frankly, performing magic.
Right, but it is a very specific, highly engineered kind of magic. At its core, that device is really doing just one fundamental thing billions of times a second. It is bossing electrons around.
Exactly. It's all about control.
So, welcome to this deep dive. Today, our mission is to explore the epic, century-long journey of exactly how humans learned to tame electricity. We are going to trace the evolution of computing hardware from its clunkiest, most accidental beginnings, all the way to the modern era.
And we have some phenomenal source material to guide us today. We are drawing from a really fascinating synthesis of hardware explainer videos by the brilliant Bilibili creator, Redknot.
Okay, let's unpack this. Because, you know, to understand the mind-boggling chips in our pockets today, the ones packed with literally 100 billion microscopic switches, we actually have to go all the way back to 1883.
We do. We have to go back to Thomas Edison, a glass light bulb, and a completely useless copper wire.
Right. Because before we could build a supercomputer, we had to catch our very first electron. So how did humanity accidentally figure out how to steer electricity?
Well, in 1883, Edison was struggling. He was still fighting to perfect the incandescent light bulb. And the filaments he was using back then, they were made of carbon.
Which has a pretty fatal flaw for light bulb.
Oh, massive flaw. If you heat carbon up enough to make it glow brightly, it literally evaporates over time. The carbon atoms boil off, the filament thins out, and eventually it just snaps. It simply does not last.
So Edison is like desperate to buy this filament a longer life, just trying to stop that black soot from coating the inside of the glass.
Yeah, and in a very trial and error, totally brute force move, he just shoves a random unattached copper wire into the vacuum bulb next to the filament.
He just sticks it in there.
Just sticks it in there, not touching anything. I mean, he was hoping it would somehow magically absorb the heat or fix the evaporation problem.
Spoiler alert, I'm guessing it didn't work.
It didn't fix a thing. The wire did absolutely nothing to save the carbon filament. But Edison noticed something highly unusual while monitoring this veiled experiment.
Oh, wow. What happened?
When the lamp was lit, a very faint, mysterious electrical current appeared in that stray copper wire.
Wait, really? Even though the wire was separated from the glowing filament by a complete vacuum?
Exactly. The electrical current was just crossing empty space.
That is wild to think about.
And Edison had absolutely no idea what this was good for. But, you know, having that pure inventor's reflex, he patented it anyway. He called it the Edison effect.
Of course, he named it after himself.
Naturally. But he really didn't realize the magnitude of what he was watching. That pointless little current crossing the vacuum was the very first time a human being watched themselves steer electrons through space.
Okay, so let's dig into the science of that. To understand the physics, we have to look at a process called thermionic emission, right?
Yes, thermionic emission. When that carbon filament glows red hot, it is packed with thermal energy. The heat causes the electrons inside the carbon to vibrate violently.
Like they're boiling.
Literally, like they are boiling. They get so energetic, so restless, that they overcome the physical bonds holding them to the atom, and they just boil off the surface, flying out in all directions into the vacuum of the bulb.
And so some of those escaping electrons just happen to crash land on that nearby copper wire, which is what created that faint current Edison saw.
You got it. We caught our first loose electron, but at this stage, it is just flying blindly into the void. To actually make use of this, you have to steer it.
Right. You can't just have them crashing around randomly.
No, so you swap out Edison's random copper wire for a specific electrode, one that you deliberately apply a positive electrical charge to. This becomes the anode.
Because electrons inherently carry a negative charge.
Exactly. And fundamental physics dictates that opposites attract.
It's like putting a giant piece of cheese in a mousetrap. You have all these restless negative electrons boiling off the filament, buzzing around in the vacuum, and then suddenly you present them with this irresistible, powerful, positive charge on the other side of the bulb.
They're naturally going to rush straight across the gap toward it. The electrons pour across the vacuum in this unified stream, and suddenly that faint accidental current grows into a real, highly usable electrical flow.
Which is amazing, but the text mentions a crucial trick here.
Right, the control aspects. Mm-hmm. Here's where it gets clever. If you flip the charge on that receiving electrode from positive to negative, the electrons hit an invisible wall.
Because negative repels negative.
Exactly. They turn right around, the current stops dead, and the circuit is open.
So basically, because of how we control the charge on the receiving side, the current can only physically flow in one direction. It passes when the charge is positive, and it gets totally blocked when the charge is reversed.
You've just created a one-way street for electricity. This is a diode.
And a one-way street is incredibly powerful in electronics.
It is the foundation of so much. I mean, the electrical grid in your house uses alternating current, or AC. The electricity is constantly sloshing back and forth, reversing direction dozens of times a second.
But your delicate electronics, like your laptop or your phone, they can't handle that chaos. They need smooth, steady, one-way power, right? Direct current or DC.
Exactly. By wiring a few of these vacuum tube diodes together, you can force that back and forth AC chaos into a single direction, flattening it out into smooth DC power.
Which is exactly what that bulky charging brick sitting on your desk is doing right now, just using modern materials.
Precisely. But early scientists, you know, they didn't stop at the diode. They wanted more than just a one-way street. They wanted a throttle.
Right. They wanted to really control the volume of the flow.
So they realized that if you take that vacuum tube and you slide a metal wire mesh directly in between the emitting filament and the receiving plate, you create what's called a triode, a tube with three components.
A triode. Okay, so how does the mesh work?
Well, by applying a very specific voltage to that middle mesh, you give it an electric field. Now, every single electron trying to fly from the hot filament to the receiving plate has to physically navigate its way past that mesh grid.
Oh, I see.
If you put a strong negative field on the mesh, it acts like a bouncer at a club. It repels the electrons and blocks almost all of them from getting through. But a weaker negative field lets a massive crowd of electrons rush past to the positive plate.
So the beautiful revolutionary part of this design is the mechanical leverage it gives you.
Exactly. Leverage is the perfect word.
Because a tiny microscopic nudge in the voltage applied to that middle grid causes a massive dramatic swing in the sheer number of electrons that actually make it across the vacuum gap.
Right. You can use a very weak, whispering electrical signal on the grid to command a roaring, powerful electrical current flowing through the main tube.
A weak signal goes in, a hugely powerful signal comes out. That is amplification.
It is. It's the absolute foundation of long-distance communication, radio, and all early audio equipment.
Which is so funny because Redknot's video brings up this great piece of trivia. There is still an entire subculture of hardcore audiophiles today who absolutely insist on building their high-end stereo amplifiers using these old-school glowing vacuum tubes.
Oh, yeah. Tube amps are a huge deal in the audio world.
Even though Redknot admits in his video that, practically speaking, most people cannot hear the difference in sound quality at all between a tube amp and a modern digital one.
It's true. But, you know, while those glass tubes look undeniably cool, glowing warm orange in a dark room, we really have to confront the brutal reality of this technology when it comes to building a computer.
Yeah, let's pivot to that. Because to me, when I really think about the mechanics of a vacuum tube we just described, we are literally boiling electrons off a piece of wire using raw physical heat.
It's incredibly primitive when you put it that way.
It sounds like pure brute force. There has to be a catastrophic energy cost here. Like, if vacuum tubes are so great at amplifying and controlling electrons, why isn't the smartphone you are holding right now just filled with tiny glowing glass bulbs?
Because the flaws of the vacuum tube are absolutely glaring. And for the purposes of modern computing, they are completely insurmountable.
So what's the biggest issue? The heat.
First and foremost, yes. That filament has to be heated red hot just to function. That means vacuum tubes run incredibly hot and burn massive amounts of power just to maintain baseline operation. You are wasting vast quantities of energy generating raw heat before you perform a single calculation.
That sounds terribly inefficient.
It is. And furthermore, they are incredibly slow to start. A vacuum tube needs anywhere from 3 to 10 seconds just to warm up to the point where electrons start boiling off.
So you can't just instantly turn on a tube computer. It has to, like, boot up its physical temperature.
Exactly. And to keep that delicate red-hot filament from instantly reacting with oxygen and burning up in the open air, the entire apparatus has to be sealed inside a fragile glass shell containing a perfect vacuum.
Heat, delicate glass, and vacuums. That sounds like a nightmare to scale up.
And here is the fatal blow. None of that can shrink. You simply cannot make a vacuum-sealed, glowing hot glass jar the size of a molecule. It is physically impossible. You hit a hard physical wall.
So they reached a dead end. Because of these limitations, the vacuum tube has mostly vanished from daily life.
Pretty much. I mean, if you tear apart a modern kitchen microwave, you will actually find a massive vacuum tube in there called a magnetron that generates the microwaves.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And the X-ray emitter inside a giant CT scanner at the hospital is a tube. But outside of those specific relics, they are gone.
So, if heat, glass, and sheer physical size are the enemies here, physicists realized they needed a material that could control electrons while staying completely solid, cold, and microscopic.
They needed to abandon glowing filaments entirely. They needed a semiconductor.
And that leads us directly to silicon. But the source material points out that silicon presents a fascinating paradox, doesn't it?
It really does. Because pure silicon is actually a terrible conductor of electricity.
Wait, really? The stuff Silicon Valley is named after doesn't conduct electricity.
Not in its pure form, no. If we look at a single silicon atom, it has exactly 4 electrons in its outermost shell. In a solid crystal of pure silicon, every single atom is perfectly holding hands with its neighboring silicon atoms using those 4 electrons.
They form tight chemical connections.
Koblenz bonds,
right? Exactly, Koblenz bonds. And because every single electron is locked down tight holding hands with a neighbor, none of them are free to move around.
And if electrons can't move, you have no electrical current.
Precisely. Pure silicon is essentially a dead piece of rock. To wake it up, to make it conductive, you have to introduce a tiny, mathematically precise amount of chemical impurities into the crystal.
A process called doping.
Right. So if you take that pure silicon and mix in a tiny bit of phosphorus, the chemical structure changes. Phosphorus atoms have 5 electrons in their outer shell, not 4.
Okay, so it has an extra one.
Exactly. So when the phosphorus atom tries to fit into the silicon crystal and hold hands with its neighbors, 4 of its electrons link up perfectly, but there is 1 extra electron left over.
Because there's no available hand for it to hold.
Right. That 5th electron has nowhere to bond. It becomes a free electron, just wandering loose through the solid material.
And because electrons carry a negative charge, this new, slightly conductive mixture is called N-type silicon. N for negative.
You got it. But the chemistry works in reverse, too. You can dope the pure silicon with a little bit of boron. Mm. And boron only has 3 outer electrons.
So now, when the boron atom tries to hold hands with the surrounding silicon atoms, it's missing a hand. It is literally 1 electron short.
Yes. It creates a physical empty space in the crystal structure where an electron should be. Physicists literally call this empty space a hole.
A hole. And because it is the sudden absence of a negative electron, this hole inherently acts like a positive charge. So we call this mixture P-type silicon.
Exactly. P for positive.
It is literally like a microscopic game of musical chairs. The pure silicon has exactly the right amount of players for the chairs, so nobody moves. It's a boring game.
That's a great way to put it.
But the N-type side has too many players, and those extra people are constantly wandering around looking for a seat. And the P-type side has extra empty chairs just waiting to be filled.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, the absolute magic trick of solid-state electronics happens when you take a single slab of silicon and you dope 1/2 of it to be N-type and the other half to be P-type.
You place the side with wandering players right next to the side with empty chairs.
Right. At the microscopic border between the 2 halves, the free electrons on the N-type side naturally diffuse across the border, dropping into the empty holes on the P-type side.
But wait, as those negative electrons physically migrate across the border, they leave behind atoms with a net positive charge on the N side, right?
Yes, and they create atoms with a net negative charge on the P side. The atoms themselves become electrically charged.
So you're building up a charge difference right at the border.
Exactly. This growing chemical imbalance builds an internal electric field right at the border. This electric field starts pulling in the exact opposite direction of the diffusing electrons. It tries to drag the negative electrons back to where they came from.
Oh, wow. So you have a tug of war.
A microscopic tug of war. The push of natural diffusion and the pull of the new electric field eventually settle into a tense, permanent standoff. A microscopic region right in the middle where nothing can cross. We call this standoff region the PN junction.
And the PM junction is the holy grail, because this solid rock of silicon with its internal electrical standoff acts exactly like the bulky glass vacuum tube diode we talked about earlier.
But with 0 heat, 0 glass, and almost 0 power drain.
It's incredible. If you apply an external voltage pointing in the right direction and you push hard enough, I think usually you need just over 0.7 volts to overpower that internal electric field standoff current suddenly flows freely across the junction.
But if you point the external voltage in the wrong direction, the junction clamps itself shut even harder. The internal standoff widens. No current gets through.
You have created a solid-state one-way street, a solid-state diode.
And this specific mechanism of physics is just so versatile.
Yeah, the text brought up two really fascinating bonus facts about this. First, these PN junctions are highly sensitive to light.
They are. If you take a PN junction and you shine sunlight onto it, the physical energy from the light particles, the photons, actually hits the silicon hard enough to knock electrons loose from their bonds.
Which produces an electrical current. That is exactly how every solar panel on the planet works. We are just harvesting the direct current from massive arrays of PN junctions.
It is a beautiful secondary property of the physics, but there is a more volatile property as well.
Right, the avalanche breakdown.
Yeah, if you take a PN junction, clamp it shut by pointing the voltage in the wrong direction, and then just keep cranking that voltage way, way up.
The physics just totally breaks down. The incredibly high voltage causes the racing electrons to accelerate so fast that they physically smash into the tightly locked covalent bonds of the silicon crystal.
They hit with such kinetic force that they shatter the bonds, knocking other electrons completely loose.
And then those newly freed electrons accelerate, smashing into more bonds, knocking even more loose. It snowballs rapidly.
Redknott compares this in his videos to the chain reaction inside an atomic bomb. Physicists call it avalanche breakdown. Now, the avalanche itself doesn't inherently destroy the silicon crystal.
But the heat does, right?
Yes. The danger is that all those billions of colliding electrons dump massive amounts of friction and heat. If you cannot shed that heat fast enough, the silicon will literally melt and burn right through.
Okay, so we have mastered the solid-state diode. We have our solid, cold, one-way street. But, you know, a one-way street is not a computer. To build a computing brain, a logic machine that can actually evaluate inputs, you need more than just traffic flowing one way.
You need a traffic light.
Exactly. You need to be able to actively turn the flow of electrons on and off on command. You need a solid-state switch.
And that brings us to the invention that fundamentally rewrote human history, the modern transistor. Let's actually engineer one right now using what we just learned.
Okay, let's build one.
We start with a tiny continuous slab of silicon. We dope two separate distinct regions to be N-type. We will call one the source and the other the drain.
But we separate them in the middle with a stretch of P-type silicon.
Right. So it is an N-type source, a P-type wall in the middle, and an N-type drain, a chemical sandwich.
And normally, the PN junctions created by that P-type wall in the middle act as a hard barrier. The internal standoff prevents any current from flowing from the source to the drain.
The switch is firmly stuck in the off position. To turn it on, we need some way to temporarily punch a hole through that wall or build a bridge over it.
And we accomplish that by adding the final genius component, the gate.
We place a new electrode directly over that middle P-type wall. But critically, we separate this electrode from the silicon below with a microscopically thin insulating film.
So the electrode never actually touches the silicon crystal. It is just hovering just above it, separated by this insulator.
What's fascinating here is how the gate asserts control from a distance, like a magnet picking up iron filings through a piece of paper. When you apply a positive voltage to that hovering gate electrode, it creates a powerful electric field that reaches straight down through the insulating film and penetrates the P-type silicon below.
Now remember, P-type silicon is mostly empty holes, but there are always a few stray negative electrons wandering around in there.
Right. And the positive field from the gate aggressively attracts those stray negative electrons, dragging them all the way up to the very top surface of the P-type region, right up against the underside of the insulating film.
Wow. So it gathers so many electrons at the surface that it forcefully forces a temporary conductive bridge into existence.
We call it an N-channel.
Yeah.
Suddenly, the N-type source and the N-type drain are connected by this new temporary bridge of electrons. The wall is bypassed, the switch is closed, current flows freely.
And the instant you drop the positive voltage on the gate, the electric field vanishes. The gathered electrons repel each other and scatter back down into the P-type material. The temporary N-channel bridge collapses instantly.
The wall is back, the switch opens again, and the current stops dead. You have total instant control over the flow of electrons.
With no moving parts, no vacuum, and no glowing filaments.
None.
Here's where it gets really interesting. Because we just perfectly described the most important piece of technology on Earth, and we demystified one of the most intimidating acronyms in science, the MOSFET, M-O-S-F-E-T.
which stands for Metal Oxide Semiconductor Field Effect Transistor.
Let's break that down based on the anatomy we just built. The metal is the gate electrode hovering on top. The oxide is that microscopically thin insulating film, usually made of silicon dioxide, which is basically silicon rust. And the semiconductor is the doped silicon sandwich underneath.
The electric field from the metal gate reaches through the oxide layer to dictate the behavior of the semiconductor below. It really is a masterpiece of material science.
The sheer mind-bending scale of this victory cannot be overstated. When we compare this microscopic MOSFET to Edison's clunky vacuum tube, I mean, it's not even a contest. The MOSFET needs no internal heating element. It needs zero warm-up time.
It doesn't oxidize in the air, so it needs no delicate glass vacuum shell. And most importantly, because it is just clever chemistry manipulated inside a single solid rock of silicon, it can shrink and shrink and shrink.
Because it is fundamentally just a pattern of chemical impurities, we stopped wiring discrete components together by hand and started physically printing these patterns onto silicon wafers using light and chemicals.
This is what unlocked the modern world. I mean, think about it. A human hair is about 80,000 nanometers wide. The structures inside a modern MOSFET are measured in single digits of nanometers.
That is insane. When you see an advertisement today bragging that the new smartphone chip integrates 100 billion transistors, they are talking about this exact architectural marvel.
It means engineers have chemically printed 100 billion of these microscopic MOSFET switches, complete with sources, drains, and oxide gates, onto a wafer of silicon the size of a postage stamp.
The physical limitations of heat and glass simply could not compete with atomic level chemistry. The vacuum tube lost cleanly to the transistor. It is the absolute pinnacle of human manufacturing capability. It allows us to build logic gates, memory arrays, and processors that operate at the speed of light.
It is an incredible century-long arc. We went from Thomas Edison staring blankly at a useless accidental current jumping to a copper wire inside a glass bulb, to engineering solid silicon at the nanometer scale to hold trillions of microscopic, highly obedient switches.
We really figured out how to get electrons fully in hand.
We certainly did. However, it is vital to remember a crucial limitation noted at the very end of our source material. A giant pile of 100 billion microscopic switches is still just a pile of switches.
Right. On their own, they cannot do arithmetic. They cannot run software or render graphics.
Exactly. Wiring those billions of switches together into a CPU architecture that actually remembers data, computes logic, and executes code is a massive hurdle all its own. And practically speaking, the physical process of drawing those nanometer scale switches onto the silicon using extreme ultraviolet light character, a process called lithography, is perhaps the most complex, difficult engineering challenge humans have ever solved.
We will definitely have to save lithography and CPU architecture for another deep dive because that is a whole other world. But as we wrap up today, I want to leave you with a final lingering thought to mull over. Our source material focused heavily on the incredible power of scaling down. We have spent the last century relentlessly shrinking these switches.
We went from bulky, glowing glass jars that fit in the palm of your hand down to invisible structures measured in nanometers.
Right. But we are building these switches out of physical silicon atoms, and atoms have a fixed physical size in the universe. So what happens to the future of technology when we physically run out of room? What happens when our 100 billion switches finally hit the absolute fundamental limit of atomic reality and we simply cannot shrink them any further?
That is the defining question for the next generation of engineers. And, you know, it may force us to rethink computing all over again.
It really might. Thank you for joining us on this deep dive. Next time you look at the device in your hand, take a moment to appreciate the billions of tiny, perfectly choreographed electron switches making it all possible. Keep questioning the hidden complexities of the everyday tech right in your hands. We'll catch you next time.